Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Here's the order that we're going to proceed with today. A work session on three bills, 821, 265, and 266, and then a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 818, Senate Bill 102, and Senate Bill 831. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 821. We've got a couple pieces of information, some documents here. Why don't you give us a quick summary first, Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 821, it allows private schools to discipline or terminate school employees according to their own internal standards and policies. It does require private schools to comply with specified reporting requirements, and it declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2013. The committee heard testimony on Senate Bill 2013 on the 4th of April, just a few days ago. It comes from a specific request made on behalf of the Catholic Church and parochial schools here that they have more freedom to discipline their employees, particularly regards higher standards of conduct that they implement in their own schools. And rather than be potentially subject to administrative requirements of public schools, they've asked that a particular section of statute not apply to them. The committee was concerned that the request was a little bit overly broad. We received a letter that's at the dais here from Legislative Counsel's office that clarifies some questions, saying that if Senate Bill 821 were to be enacted, the reporting requirements currently in statute would still be upheld. Those statutes would still be applicable to those schools, but the disciplinary proceedings such as paid administrative leave, notice requirements, those were the provisions that would no longer be applicable to parochial schools. There's also a letter at the dais responding to some questions from the advocate on behalf of the Catholic schools here, Mr. Roger Martin, who testified, and the letter answers some of the questions that were asked in testimony.
Okay, so you have the Legislative Council letter, and if there are any questions on any of this, if not, then we'll proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'll bet we're in work session.
We are.
All right. I move Senate Bill 821 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 821 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 821 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Knope, we are down to you. Would you like to carry this bill, please?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 821 and call up Alethea Miller to help us with these next two bills. Work session on Senate Bill 266 is now open. Is Alethea prepared to do a quick summary?
I hope so.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 266 creates an individualized process for the Oregon University System to enter into financing agreements. This bill authorizes the chancellor to enter into financial agreements without the Department of Administrative Services approval. This is declared emergency passage. There is a proposed -1 amendment which requires the state treasurer to review and approve the terms and conditions of these agreements.
All right. Is there somebody from the university system here to talk about the amendment? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Green, for the record. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration and Controller for the Oregon University System. Working with the State Treasurer's Office, we crafted some amendments to the bill to address their concerns that they had with regard to the original text of the bill. Originally, they were not in the loop with financing agreements that the university system might enter into, and they had concerns about the interplay with these financing agreements and revenue bonds that we might issue. They were concerned that we might, in entering into financing agreements, pledge the similar or same revenue streams that would be pledged with revenue bonds, and so this was a way to put in place an approval process to ensure they're looking over our shoulders to make sure that doesn't happen.
Let me ask you a broader question.
Sure.
What what, how does this bill with the amendment change the current situation? What problem are we fixing?
Currently, excuse me, Senator Hess, members of the committee, currently, in order for us to enter in financing agreements, we need to have legislative authority. And that comes in two ways. Either we can ask for legislative authority specific for a financing agreement through the capital process, or we can have it allocated to us by DAS from their, they have a, usually are allocated or are authorized by the legislature, a blanket amount of financing agreement authority. So either we have to have it specific or allocated through DAS. This would eliminate that requirement that we have to get that authorization.
Okay. And this is in keeping with the spirit, I think, of Senate Bill 242.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And, yeah, and we have heard this before. This does now have a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. That was my concern because it didn't initially happen.
Mr. Chair.
So, okay.
Senator Bach.
Just a question. I realize we haven't passed, I think it's 370 yet, the governor's issue. Will this be consistent with that as well, if that is passed?
How would this interface with the university board's legislation that's going through?
Senator Hass, Senator Beyer. This contemplates the current governance structure because it authorizes the chancellor to enter into agreements for the Oregon University system. I think we'd have to look at that to see how that would fit under a different governance structure. It might, given what I've seen of the Dash 3s, and I think there's some others coming, it might not apply to the universities that have separate boards. I'd have to.
Well, that's as good as answer as you can get because it's still up in the air.
Yeah.
But I will say that the university boards will have their own bonding authority, at least for revenue funds.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're in work session. Senator Mills.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 266, dated April 2, 2013.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 2, 2013. Discussion? Seeing none, objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Hass, I move Senate Bill 266 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 266 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the measure goes to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Two down.
It's 266. The dash one.
The bombing going on.
True. And I would like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 265.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 265 authorizes the issuance of higher education revenue bonds in addition to bonds authorized pursuant to the biennial budget process for bond authorization. It removes the necessary approval from the Oregon Legislative Assembly.
Okay. Go ahead.
Senator Hass, members of the committee, the testimony that I gave in a public hearing a few weeks ago is that basically that we are seeking this authority to just the same as the financing agreement statute change. We would, right now, we have to request bonding authority from the legislature to seek and issue revenue bonds. What this bill would do would be remove that requirement. It has in it some important fences around it. Universities would not be able to issue debt beyond the debt capacity as the board has described or has prescribed in policy. So there's that control in place over that. But that's exactly what this bill does. It just removes that legislative requirement.
Right. Okay. And this also goes to Ways and Means. Any questions? Okay. Senator Knope.
I'm thinking about it, Mr. Chair. Chair Hass, I move Senate Bill 265 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 265 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. The measure goes to Ways and Means. Thank you.
She's quicker than me.
She is a little faster on the draw, that's for sure. I would now like to open up a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 818. Richard, give us a quick summary.
It's 218.
818.
Did I say 218? Trying to throw us a curve. Huh?
Yeah. Senator Montes Anderson is here.
Senate Bill 818 requires school district boards to adopt a policy related to cardiac incidents, specifically a particular type of cardiac incident often caused by blunt force trauma. I believe, hopefully I'm pronouncing this correctly, I'm going to let Senator Montes answer.
Arrhythmia?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson, representing Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. Thank you for hearing this bill. The idea came from me from the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, and they have passed legislation like this in 44 other states. Basically, this is commotio cordis, or chest trauma, is the leading cause of traumatic death in youth baseball and the third leading cause of sudden cardiac death in all young athletes. And it affects young athletes with an average age of 14.7 years. The fatality rate is high, but the survival rate is increasing once there's a growing awareness for this condition. And the risk of death can be reduced through some simple interventions, such as education to avoid direct blows to the breastbone, that's obvious, but then improved recognition and resuscitation with CPR and AED. And as you all know about AEDs, Senator Haas was very instrumental in getting a bill passed having AEDs in public places. But increasing the availability at youth sporting venues is extremely important. When you have blunt force trauma, you have 3 minutes, basically a minute to get the AED, a minute to get back to the athlete, and then a minute to resuscitate. So I know you've only allowed 10 minutes, and we have other more expert people to testify, and I hope that you will look very seriously at this bill and see somehow how we can help get this idea through the legislature. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And any questions for Senator Montes Anderson? I don't know if you have to go or if you can stay, but you're joined by our colleague, Senator Dr. Steiner Hayward. If you could weigh in for us on Senate Bill 818.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17, Northwest Portland, unincorporated Washington County. And as the Chair mentioned, I'm also a family physician on faculty at Oregon Health and Science University. I really want to support the concept behind this bill, but also express some concerns about whether this is exactly the right time to pass exactly this bill. You have in OLIS a letter from the President of the Medical Advisory Council for the Oregon, for OSAA, the sports the body that oversees high school sports in Oregon, and two sports medicine physicians who also serve on that committee, and I happen to be colleagues of mine at OHSU. I personally had a bill that was similar, which related to the issue around sudden cardiac death, which is also a huge problem in terms of unanticipated death in young athletes, trying to educate coaches about this condition, just as Senator Montes Anderson's bill hopes to educate them about commotio cordis. But the doctors who presented the information that's in the letter in OLIS pointed out to me that there are two significant challenges right now. The first is that unlike the situation for concussion, and this committee was very gracious in helping us pass Senate Bill 721A, we do not yet have clear standardized education to teach coaches and parents and kids about the warning signs of sudden cardiac death and how to intervene with commotio cordis. And the second is that OSAA is in the middle of developing a very broad emergency preparedness plan that includes not only medical emergencies such as these, but also mass events at sporting venues, earthquakes, all those kinds of things that anybody involved with sports that attract lots of people to them needs to be aware of. So their hope is that to be able to incorporate the concerns raised both by this bill and the bill 720 that I chose not to ask the chair to move forward because of their concerns into that plan, which they anticipate is going to be ready in the next 6 to 12 months at the most, and then have standardized education that everybody can participate in that's part of this broader emergency preparedness program, which I think is critical for our young athletes and those who watch their games. So in principle, I really, really support this bill. I just have a few concerns that were raised by some of my colleagues about whether this is exactly the right time and way to get this education out to people. So that's what I hope to offer to the committee.
Senator Cruz.
First, a couple of things, Mr. Chair. First, I didn't realize earthquake was a sporting event. But
no, but they happen while people are at sporting events, Senator Cruz.
I've been to lots of sporting events, seen no earthquakes. I guess.
There was a big baseball game.
1986 World Series.
But I wasn't there.
If you weren't there, it didn't happen, Senator.
That's right. I guess one of my concerns, and I understand, there's good intentions here, is we just did an expansion of sport safety, and one of my concerns is trying to do too much all at once and overloading the system is part of my concern.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's certainly a concern, although I think that most coaches do have to go through annual education, and adding in a new module probably wouldn't be that hard. The concern that I think my colleagues and now I share is whether we can be confident that the education that they would get about this topic and about one that I was also bringing about sudden cardiac death would be standardized, recommended by the heart specialist, recommended by the sports medicine specialist, evidence-based, and whether we would be able to have that kind of education available consistent in a timely fashion in a way that could be provided in the same way the concussion training is now available.
Senator Rubble.
Thank you. And I guess my concern is if we know certain conditions that arise that can do it, and it's like a sudden blow to the chest, and we aren't having that conversation even today, and we know what we don't have AEDs every place, so that's probably not going to be the thing to use. But you can do compression, and you can get the heart going. And there has been a lot of change in that. I mean, you don't do the mouth-to-mouth as much anymore. You do a lot of other kinds of things depending on the age. And having this as part of what we do, because the reality is kids are going to have heart conditions in baseball games and football games. And therefore, there is a standard practice, and
right.
Call 911, get people there, and start compression. I mean,
right.
we already know that, but if a person recognizes and it's highlighted the fact that they should watch for those sudden hits, and, you know, the one that I think about is the person that's just trying to stop the other base runner and gets hit in the chest with the other person. It's not the baseball, because the baseball one, it's pretty obvious. You see what happens, and you kind of run out to do it. But some of these other deals, that chest hit can be not as observable. And having a conversation about it with the coaches beforehand, I think, is really important. So I think there are standardized practices that people should know. I'm not saying that they aren't going to do more and whatever, but I every once in a while think we wait sometimes, and what's the consequences of the waiting when we know certain practices already? So I.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rubin, you raise an important point, and I think I would distinguish between two different kinds of standardized practices. I personally think that everybody who comes, I mean, I think everybody from age about 11 up should be trained in hands-only CPR.
Right.
Everybody. I don't care what you do. I don't care what your job is. I don't care who you are. Anybody can do this, and I think everybody should. There was a bill that you all were considering, I don't know what its status is, to require CPR training, hands-only CPR schools. Training for high school students. I don't know where that stands.
Senate Bill 275.
Thank you. I'm not good at remembering these numbers. I don't know what its status is, but I think it's a great bill, and I hope that we get it through. So that kind of training, and I believe, I don't know this for a fact, so please forgive me if I'm wrong, I believe that coaches are currently required to have current CPR training. And so, in theory, any event where someone collapses should trigger an automatic response of call 911 and get out there and do the ABC, you know, airway breathing circulation evaluation and start compressions right away. But that's separate. It doesn't really matter what the cause is at that point. It just matters that this kid is down, and those are the basic evaluation that you should do in any emergent situation like this.
Mr. Chair, in deference to time, I have a parents here and a team physician from Oregon State and another physician here to talk, and then
I'll
maybe
be happy
have
to.
This, because I know you said we only had 10 minutes. Okay.
Yeah,
and
I'm
really
happy
would like to have the parents
yeah, let's
be
hear
able
from
to.
Them.
Okay. Thanks.
Barry, Marina, and Alex, and Doug.
Hello.
Welcome to the Capitol.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 818 today. We're here to support this bill because we lost our son, Austin, when he was only 11 years old. And we lost him to Commodio cordis, we've been told by examiner, medical examiner. Commodio cordis is an often...
Excuse me, Marie, could you start off with your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Marina Sergeev. And commodio cordis is an often little disruption of a heart rhythm that occurs as a result of a blow to the heart area directly over the heart at a critical time during the cycle of a heartbeat. Austin died during school recess. The kids were playing flag football, and he was hit in the chest with the ball. He fell to the ground, and within a few minutes, he was gone. He would be alive if the person who was supposed to be watching kids that day was there, watching kids, paying close attention, and having a defibrillator right there by her side. Schools must have information for kids, parents, and students on risks and what to do in these traumatic situations. It could help avoid tragedies. When commotio cordis occurs, you do not have much time to react to save a life. Negligence of a school staff, not knowing what to do, CPR and defibrillator, not having defibrillator on the field where the kids were playing, took Austin from us. It is very sad that the school thinks it was an accident. We think they took our boy, our life, our future, to their lack of preparation for this kinds of situation. As a parent, we urge you to support this bill. And actually, Austin was at the recess. He don't like play football, as a newspaper said, they were playing flag football. He don't like balls. He always was afraid. So it was like, we don't know who hit him. But when he collapsed, that's what kids told us. Nobody knew what's happening. Kids thought he just fell. And adult was nowhere around. And they didn't save Austin. Emergency arrived too late. Adult person who was supposed to be there, she was not there. She was not watching. When he collapsed, she probably didn't even see it happen. So really like this bill to be passed. It's very scary to send your kids to school. We don't have one yet, but it's very scary to send a child to a school when he can die in recess. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, questions?
We're so sorry for your loss. You can't even imagine. Questions? Thank you. Doug Ankerman? Barry Rhodes?
Thank you, committee, Senator Chairman. My name is Barry Rhodes. I'm a sports medicine family physician who practices in Milwaukee, Oregon at Northwest Primary Care. I'm appearing in support of Senate Bill 818. I'd just like to thank the parents for testifying. I know how difficult that must have been. Commotio cordis is a rare, potentially fatal heart rhythm, as the mother said, that occurs when a blunt object, either a ball or hand or head, strikes the chest area of a young adult. It has to happen at exactly the right time in the heartbeat cycle. So it is a very rare event. It does not happen every time an object strikes a chest. 90% of the cases occur in people under 25 years of age. That is because as we grow, the sternum or cartilage area around the chest does harden and is not as soft. So children have a softer chest area, and that lends them more at risk for this. There were 250 cases in the U.S. on a registry in the last 16 years, but this is probably underreported as not all states mandate reporting. It actually causes more deaths per year than concussions in young athletes. And I know that we all are concerned about concussions, but if you look at actual deaths, this is more. It is the leading cause of traumatic death in youth baseball and the third leading cause of sudden cardiac death in all athletes. I do have a personal story. When I was a resident, one of my patients, her grandson, had this happen and did survive thanks to chest compression, and as a result of that, all youth baseball fields were mandated to have AEDs. This was in Oklahoma. So I'll hand my time over to Dr. Aukerman.
And I'm Doug Aukerman, a physician in Corvallis, director of sports medicine at Oregon State University, and I'm testifying on behalf of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine. You've already heard what commotio cordis is. I think it's important to point out that this bill really is an education piece, and it's really a knowledge piece. And without education and knowledge, this potential condition, which is a arrhythmia, which does have a survival rate which increases above 40% to 50% if treated promptly and rapidly, if you don't have knowledge of it, you're not going to have any survivability. You know, the survivability drops to less than 5%. So I do understand the other senator who is working on other more diverse legislation. This is really an education piece for one specific cause that can have a dramatic and profound outcome and difference. I will also share a personal story that I was a resident at Wake Forest University in North Carolina and was actually working in the emergency room receiving a football athlete who had commotio cordis and was revived on the field with CPR and an AED. And it is really an amazing thing to realize that you can have an outcome with education.
What's the relationship with this and arrhythmia? Are they both the same?
So this is a blow to the chest, which at the right time in the cardiac cycle develops a fibrillation or an abnormal rhythm. So the AED is a shock which then will restart back into a normal rhythm, but you have a very finite window when you can apply that shock to where it is successful. This is different than other sudden cardiac death, which we may attempt to screen for with EKGs and echoes and everything else that may not be really detectable. And when those people go into an abnormal rhythm, it may or may not be recoverable. This one is an arrhythmia that for a brief period of time is recoverable.
Senator Roper.
Thank you. So is the compression enough or does it need the shock?
It's more effective with the AED.
Okay. But you have a little longer if you're doing the compression if someone's running to get a...
You can, depending on how effective it is.
Okay. Thanks. That's good to know.
Well, we thank you very much for coming to the Capitol.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Anyone else here on Senate Bill 818? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 818. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 102.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 102 revises the fee structure for schools requiring approval of Higher Education Coordinating Commission to confer or offer academic degrees or provide services leading to degrees. It declares an emergency effective on passage. It, in some, relates to the Office of Degree Authorization, which has been doing some of this work already and wants to clarify some of their statutory authorities and similar.
Yes, thank you. Could you straighten us out on this?
Senator Haas and Vice Chair Knopp and members of the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. My name is Hilda Rosselli, and I serve as Deputy Director for College and Career Readiness for the Oregon Education Investment Board. In that capacity this year, I support the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and serve in an oversight role for the Office of Degree Authorization, which is currently housed with the Oregon Education Investment Board. I'm accompanied today by Jennifer Diallo, the Director of Degree Authorization, and we are both here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 102, which authorizes differentiated fee structures for the various levels and types of program and institutional reviews carried out by ODA staff, and which would reduce the backlog of reviews that have increased due to the growing number of out-of-state online programs. I also have provided you with written testimony from the HEC chairs, both Betty Duvall and Vice Chair Neil Bryant, also both in favor of this bill, which I've submitted for your review. And Ms. Diallo is here to provide you with the context that explains the intent and the need for this bill, and will be able to answer any questions regarding its impact.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill, Senator Haas, or Chair Haas, and members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Diallo, Director of the Office of Degree Authorization. And I'm just going to briefly go through some slides just to have some notes, and we'll be happy to take questions at the end. Currently, we have a fee structure which doesn't reflect the workload. It's normal, I suppose, with a statutory fee structure, there's a certain amount of inflexibility. And because our fee structure is set up to in relation to the level of the degree, it doesn't necessarily reflect the complexity of the work that each type of degree or each type of school engenders.
So, and your office charges a university, if someone earns a master's degree, you say, okay, it's going to be $3,000 because you have to do the due diligence on...
Right. We don't charge for each degree but we charge a school to offer a degree. And so essentially we do a biennial or, you know, a periodic evaluation of the school, both its general administrative and operations, the qualifications of the staff and faculty. And then for each program that's introduced, we do a thorough evaluation, initial evaluation, and then renewal or periodic evaluations for reauthorization of each degree program offered.
So these you charge per program, not per student?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. So if a school has, say, 15 degrees, we're charging for each of those. Depending on what level the degree is, there are different fees, and I'll show you that in just a moment. So ODA also has other functions, and because we have had our general fund reduced over the last two biennium, we're essentially fee-funded, and so our fees cover not only the actual review of the school and the programs, but it also covers ongoing oversight, support to the schools, you know, response to questions and issues that might be brought by students or by schools requesting oversight, requesting technical assistance to develop new programs or to make changes in their organizational structure. All of these things have to be supported by the fees, and because the fees don't necessarily support all degrees at the same level, you know, it's difficult to provide those services. There's a lot of staffing allocation that goes also to these unfunded tasks, and some of these are things like program change requests, where there's a need for, in order to meet employer demands or licensing board changes or accreditation changes, a school may have to change their programs mid-cycle. Then that's another, you know, they come to us with proposed changes that we need to review and approve before their accreditor will approve them, and that work is unfunded currently because we're not allowed to charge an additional fee. We're only allowed to charge the fee at the time of the program review. Our fee structure currently is such that doctoral degrees require or have the highest cost. Certificate and associate programs have the lowest cost. So you can see that $5,635 is the fee for a doctoral degree, $1,025 for a certificate program. The reality is that a lot of times a startup school will offer certificate programs and associate's degrees, and so there's more technical assistance and more oversight provided to the schools that are beginning to offer programs at the lower level, and there are tend to be more program changes, more turnover of faculty because these are shorter-term programs. They're very occupational specific. People tend to teach part-time in the programs. So there's a lot more sort of work on our part related to these lower programs that don't generate enough fees to support our work. Meanwhile, we have very few doctoral degrees, and those tend to be at schools that are already have, you know, substantial accreditation and oversight and internal sort of control mechanisms and program review process. And so they tend to not be as staff time intensive for us. The single review structure, basically, it causes redundant processes because our review process is such that the entire, the structure is, you know, for one fee you get the program and school review. So with each application we're reviewing the entire school structure, all of the administrative personnel. It's difficult to hire contractors to do the work because, you know, you have different people than looking at the general school structure. By separating the fee into two parts, we would have more flexibility to hire contractors for subject matter expert types of reviews of the academic programs or the occupational programs, and then keep the ongoing oversight and review of the school operations, the student support services, and those things in-house with our staff so that we retain the familiarity with the school's operations and stay on track with that. Again, it doesn't support the ongoing oversight that schools request of us and the technical assistance that are not fee-funded currently and that are not really included in the fee that we charge for the program review. Separating the review in two parts allows for more flexibility in staff assignment. It allows for use of contractors when we do have a backlog, as we currently do, just because of the enormous growth we've had with the online programs and also with a lot more of the occupational and associate's degree programs and certificates. It also allows us to support all different types of school under our oversight. One of the things with our current fee structure is that we have schools that are very complex in nature. They might have multiple campuses. They might have a headquarters in another state that we're dealing with, and also staff at the campus here. And then another school might be a very small college local to Oregon that has a very small staff that's been at the college for quite a long period of time. We're essentially charging the same amount of money for very different processes, for, you know, very different scope of sort of interactions and communications and intense sort of staff investment. So having more flexibility, one of the fees that we propose, I don't know if I can go back to that, one of the fees that we propose is to add a fee that is the sort of school oversight fee for a biennial period. So that provides for the site visits, it provides for the ongoing technical assistance and support, and it's differentiated between, depending on whether the school has a more complex structure or a less complex structure, so that a school with one campus and sort of a small smaller structure would be $1,000 per biennium, and a school that has a more complex structure, multiple campuses, where we're doing more site visits, more oversight, reviewing more qualifications of faculty and staff because it's a much larger operation. So we would charge an additional $1,000 for that school. So I think I'm on here, right? So again, the growth in the workload doesn't match ODA staffing or fees, and I've put a table here that shows just the change in the overall number of things that we're processing. If you look at 2010, the number of degree and non-degree programs, this is from a report presented to the OSAC Commission at the time, was 251 total. This year, our most recent figure last week is 1,649 degree programs and certificate programs offered by out-of-state schools online with very little ability to really oversee them in any substantial way, but most of those are professional programs. A lot of them are related to licensure, and so we do have an obligation to make sure that those programs meet licensing requirements, that students are going to be licensed in Oregon after they finish an online degree program offered by another state. And it's created a substantial workload for us. So just in terms of volume, the workload has increased tremendously, but in terms of the complexity and the scope of the work, it's also changed quite a bit. And we need a fee structure that's more flexible to allow for allocation of staffing resources in such a way and support of those staffing resources in order to be able to accomplish the full scope of our work. So just to summarize, increasing and restructuring these fees will stabilize our staffing and ensure more long-term sustainability, because there will be some increase overall in fee revenues just provided by the more alignment with the workload. Support improvements and maintenance of ODA's application and data management system, which we've been difficult to maintain because of the insufficient staffing and insufficient fee revenues. And also support more efficiency in the agency review processes due to the fact that we'll have more flexibility and the ability to hire contract subject matter experts when we need to for program reviews in order to facilitate getting those done more quickly. It's been a hardship on a lot of our schools where they make a substantial investment to get a new program off the ground, and then they're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for the review to be accomplished. And sometimes they also then have to go to a licensing board or accreditor afterwards and get that approved. So there's another additional process after that. Veterans approval, again, might take some more time. And so there are substantial length of time that a school would have made an investment before they can actually get a program off the ground. We think that by having a more flexible fee structure, we'll be able to reduce that time, that delay to getting the programs reviewed and implemented and meeting workforce demand. This is also a more fair and balanced fee assessment model. Right now, we're charging the same fee to everyone, but we're not providing the same amount of service to everyone, because we do have an obligation for student protection and oversight of programs that aren't necessarily paying the full price for that service because of the inflexibility of the structure. And it will stabilize our fee revenues for better biennial budgeting. And that's very important to us, because we are fully fee-funded in the next proposed budget. And so, this is our plan to make sure that we can continue to operate and provide the services to the students and schools under our oversight, and also for the good of the citizens of Oregon. I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
I noticed from your previous slide you have an explosion of online courses, which I guess is no surprise, online degrees, most of them out-of-state schools. And so, that makes sense. You have to go to these. How does that work logistically, mechanically? What do you have to? You get an online degree from a place you've never heard of. And what do you do?
Essentially, what we do is we're verifying their accreditation. We're making sure that they have the right programmatic accreditations for licensing. We're making sure that we know who's responsible for the program, who we can contact in case of any student issues, and we're making sure that they know that we have certain sort of expectations in Oregon in terms of support of students, supervision of students in clinical placements and student teaching environments, and that we expect students will be able to be licensed after they graduate with this degree. And so we send, with every approval letter, we send a list of the Oregon licensing boards and insist that they contact the licensing board. A lot of the workload we've had over the last years is just because this has exploded with essentially no regulation. And so we have a number of students who've enrolled, particularly nurses, we've had a lot of issues with, and we work really closely with the nursing board to try and kind of close those gaps. But we've had a lot of issues where students are ready to go into a clinical placement and the school has never been approved and the school doesn't want to get approval. And, we've seen a lot of schools sort of deciding this is too much trouble and telling the student they have to transfer, they have to come and do their clinical in the home state. And so we can intervene and say, if you enrolled a student in Oregon, our expectation is that you're going to see them through to the end of the program and make sure that they get licensed. So
what safeguards do you have? I know this is off from fees, but what safeguards do you have, especially with this proliferation of online degrees, that they're all above board?
Currently, all of the schools that we've approved, we've received 552 applications, and over 1,600 different programs have been approved at 147 schools, and all of those schools are regionally accredited. And so we realize that that's not necessarily a foolproof way to monitor distance education. There's a lot of work going on at the national level, and we're very involved in that to see how we might all work together for a better system that, you know, can provide these safeguards. There are some issues, you know, with getting something like that approved to work together in 50 states, but I'm confident that we all recognize that this is something that needs to be sorted out, and you know, there's a lot of support on the HEC as well to find good ways to make sure that students are protected. I think thus far we haven't had a single situation that we haven't been able to resolve. So I think we're doing a pretty good job of getting the word out there. And I know some of the licensing boards have also been instrumental in providing information to people in their field, saying, you know, kind of what to look for and what to make sure is in place when you go into an online program. There are plans to provide more of that information through initiatives with the OEIB and with the HEC going forward. So, you know, we're all working to make sure that this horse stays near the barn, I guess I can say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Office of Degree Authorization has been a really good partner with all of this for many, many years, and I appreciate the work. And so I was happy you mentioned the regional accreditation groups, and I think some people don't necessarily know, but most of our high schools also get accredited through Northwest Accreditation or whatever. Mm-hmm. And and that series goes across the country. They're all interconnected. Are there multiple ones besides the one that I always think of as the Northwest?
Yes, there's one for each region.
Okay.
And presumably they're all the same. They have similar standards and practices.
They do meet regularly, too, to exchange.
And do they require an on-site, even in with the other schools, to check the credentials and do all that kind of stuff from time to time?
They do.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's pretty much the same, even for mm-hmm. the online schools?
Yes.
And then they follow through to check on the accreditation of the teachers and make sure that they have the degrees that they say
yes.
they have and all that before you have to look at it. So, okay.
That's a good sort of clearinghouse mm-hmm. resource.
Are we doing any that have not been? Have any of the groups that have not chosen to go through the one of the regional accreditations asked
we
for?
Do. We have had a lot of schools that have Distance Education and Training Council accreditation request approval. Some of those have been approved just recently. The Distance Education and Training Council actually does a very good job of oversight evaluation of distance education in particular, which has been, you know, it's been a little bit hit and miss sometimes with the regional accreditors in the past for distance education, although in recent years they've made great strides in really doing a much better job of overseeing. I think the presumption of a lot of people was if a school's good on the ground, then they're doing a good job of okay. distance education. And I think, you know, there's a learning curve to that, and so it wasn't necessarily the case, but it's getting much better with the regional accreditors. And I think they, you know, they've taken a huge, made huge strides in
overseeing. So the individual programs are approved as well. So mm-hmm. The one that I've noticed along, BYU has had an a distance learning component for years and years.
Yes.
It's kind of the only one for a long time. And so their online portion or their distance learning portion would have a separate review within mm-hmm. the organization to make sure that it's approved.
Yeah, and actually BYU also got DETC accreditation because they wanted to have that distance learning particular type of accreditation.
Okay.
So a lot of schools have done that dual accreditation. And then they also need programmatic accreditations for specific types of programs, say for teaching or nursing or, you know, psychology, or there's all kinds of different field-specific accreditations. So a lot of what we're doing with the online programs is verifying those accreditations.
Can you explain the category religious exemption review?
There is a set of statutes in, I think it's 348.604, that allows schools to operate in Oregon under a category called religious exemption if they have a one-time review and at the time of the review, they are found to have adequately qualified faculty and facility and this type of thing. So essentially, a lot of the religious exempt programs are churches that are offering an associate's degree program or some kind of a, you know, master's in divinity or that type of thing. They are limited use degrees. However, they are often transferred to other religious colleges that may have accreditation, and so, you know, they're not specifically necessarily limited in the sense that is sort of outlined in statute. So there are 7 schools in Oregon now. There have been as many as 16. Once they're approved for religious exemption, once they've met these standards, they're no longer reviewed, and they submit an annual report saying that they still, a self-certification, essentially, under statute that says they still meet those standards, and we do not have the authority to evaluate them once they've been exempted.
Senator Roman? Yeah, follow up on that one. So would a religious school that has a university program that actually does have regular, do they have certain programs which they do that way inside of them? So
no.
So they do the
in
whole
exempt
school.
Status? No.
Yes, okay.
The so larger, you know, if you're talking about, if I understand the question correctly, Senator Roebling, you're talking about a school that's a religious college that
right.
might have some religious degrees but also secular degrees.
Correct.
No, they generally would have either regional accreditation or some type of U.S. Department of Ed recognized accreditation for all of their degrees, and they wouldn't have exemption. These schools really are essentially churches that have a very, you know, sort of robust education program, and they've sort of transformed it into a degree of some kind. Some of them are online as well. And I might mention that it's a little unclear. We've had a lot of requests from out-of-state schools for religious exemption, and it's a little unclear to us how to apply that, because normally we have to do a review, and presumably we can't do a review of a school that's out-of-state without a substantial cost and staffing time. And
careful.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we have, you know, again, on the other hand, we can't necessarily treat in-state and out-of-state schools differently due to the Commerce Clause. So, you know, it's a little bit of a catch-22.
Well, thank you for the education on this part of higher education that we don't always see. Any other questions?
I'll just make a comment. You know, for the years that I've been here and even when I was in school, the Office of Degree Authorization has had a really high esteem
yes.
amongst organizations around the country of the same nature, and they've worked really hard at making sure that when they say something, the rest of us can feel pretty comfortable with it. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I concur.
Thank you very much, Senator Roebling. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Jessica Adamson, did you want to add on to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson, and I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. Our federation represents both degree-granting and certificate-granting institutions in the state of Oregon, and we are here today in support of Senate Bill 102. Our institutions are regulated by both ODA and the Office of Education Private Career Schools Unit. Our institutions in Oregon, the for-profit post-secondary sector, accounts for 69% of the state's undergraduate certificates, 21% of the associate's degrees, 8% of bachelor degrees, and 2% of master's degrees. Our sector primarily serves folks who have been through traditional education and for whom that sector has not served them well come to our institution so that they can come in, get an education, get out, and get a job. We are here in support of Senate Bill 102 because for our institutions, time matters. And we work closely with the Office of Degree Authorization to get programs approved. approved. And today we face very long backlogs, not because they don't have dedicated individuals like Ms. Diallo who work very hard to produce outcomes, but because they don't have enough individuals to process applications. As you saw in Ms. Diallo's slides, the explosion of online, out-of-state institutions asking for review by ODA has really swamped their office. And so in-state institutions, brick-and-mortar institutions like members of the Career Colleges Federation are put, you know, in order, but in order behind lots of online institutions, and we can wait 6, 8, 12, 24 months to get our programs approved. All of that time holding and waiting for students who are expecting to be able to be enrolled, get their education, and move on. This bill, we believe, despite the increase in fees, we believe will result in better outcomes for our students and for our institutions. They'll be able to get those approvals faster. We'll be able to get the kind of technical assistance on which we rely. And frankly, it starts to build some parity between the out-of-state institutions that today might pay $250 for a review, whereas an institution like our own may pay $4,000. $1,000 for a review, starts to bring parity between those two and create some fairness. We would be remiss while we're here speaking in support of this bill, which we urge you to pass two ways and means to get on its way, if we didn't also mention our support for consolidating both the private career schools unit of ODE and ODA into one effective institution, one effective agency that regulates both degree granting and career certificate schools. It's our belief that these two offices, both of whom are small and mighty and work very hard to regulate this sector, deserve a larger seat at the table. And by consolidating the agencies, we believe not only would we gain efficiencies by having a larger office that can more flexibly respond to workload issues, but you also get a more consistent regulator who can look at issues, whether it's certificate granting or degree granting, and regulate with some consistency for both sides of the same sector. Both agencies are moving into the HEC as of June 30th this year, and perhaps based upon what legislation this body may consider into a Department of Post-Secondary Education, that seems to us to be a good moment to merge these agencies, to achieve the efficiencies that could come from such a merger, and to enable Oregon to continue to be a robust leader in regulation of not only the for-profit sector, but of really all institutions that rely on the hard work of both ODA and the Career Colleges Unit. Again, we support Senate Bill 102. We look forward to working with you and to continue to work with the ODA to regulate our sector and move forward. Thank you.
Merge, streamline, consolidate. That's crazy talk.
Shocking, I know. We think it makes good sense.
Well, these it does, agencies. And I know that's one of many moving pieces on the governance dilemma in higher ed. But thank you for those comments. Any
thank
questions
you.
For Jessica? Thank you all for coming. This does have a Ways and Means referral. We need the fiscal paper to send it on its way, but we will shortly. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 102 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 831. Senator Shields is standing by.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 831 changes the amount of money received from federal government and the Department of Transportation must expend to increase diversity in highway construction in the highway construction workforce. With the goal of preparing individuals interested in entering the highway construction workforce, and it necessitates conducting certain specified activities. It specifically targets supporting minorities, women, and emerging small businesses in the construction trades.
Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22. Happy to bring you Senate Bill 831, which has broad support from business, labor, the state agencies involved, as well as a bipartisan and bicameral coalition of legislators who are also co-sponsors of this bill. In 2009, we passed the Jobs and Transportation Act, and as part of that negotiation, this body passed Senate Bill 894 to set aside 0.5% of federal flex funds for this kind of programming to improve pre-apprenticeship training, as well as to not only 0.5%, but to limit that up to $1.5 million. Federal flex funds for pre-apprenticeship training. Since then, some things have changed. First of all, we are on the cusp of making a much more significant investment in highway construction with the I-5 replacement project. And two, our workforce has continued to age, retire, and we need to really continue to work on expanding that pipeline of people into the trades. What we've also seen since 2009 is having that $1.5 million limit has made the funding Portland-centric, in that only the groups that were currently doing this kind of work could really take advantage of this funding. What this bill would do is, since the 0.5% is in statute, the $1.5 million cap is in statute, in this bill, we've left those blank. We're encouraging you to send this down to Ways and Means so that we can continue a discussion of what the appropriate amount would be. I can tell you that I proposed making the cap $4.5 million, so going from $1.5 to $4.5. Boley and ODOT have suggested that $2.1 would be the appropriate number. What we're encouraging you to do is to send it down to Ways and Means so that that discussion can continue down in Ways and Means. And I think that one of the things that would be beneficial of increasing that cap in a significant way is that to make this funding no longer Portland-centric, to allow places like Bend, Umpqua Community College, and others to also develop their own pre-apprenticeship training programs from scratch and help feed the pipeline from all over the state. So, again, I would encourage you to pass this bill down to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Shields? Okay. Looks like you've got a team coming up behind you here. So.
And I'll head back to committee.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Matt Garrett. Bring up a panel, Agnes Balassa and Steve Sims. We don't see transportation people around here much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my favorite senator is Senator Beyer on this committee. I just want you to
know. I was going to say, you guys have you met?
You just lost four votes by
yeah. That's
right. Fair enough.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I am Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's a privilege to be here. And listening to Senator Shields' words, it did remind me that we at ODA have a responsibility not only to build and maintain our transportation infrastructure, our physical capacity, but we also must build the human capacity as well. And that's why I come here before your committee today in support of Senate Bill 831, as it allows additional investment and continues the forward lean or the forward motion to increase diversity as well as assisting the preparation of individuals to enter into the heavy highway construction workforce here. As the good senator indicated, both Oregon and federal law dictate the amount, the type of funds, and the types of activities that can assist in growing the workforce in this discipline. And currently, through an interagency agreement we have with our friends at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we allocate about $1.5 million of those federal surface transportation funds each biennium to assist in a vast array of efforts targeting support services, basic skills training, training, counseling, and educational opportunities, which encourage individuals to enter into, as well as complete heavy highway construction programs. The investment seeks to move people from the pre-apprentice status to the apprentice and then on to a journey-level status, and in turn grows a more diverse and robust workforce. So, again, in consultation with a very positive and healthy business partner at Boley, we've had conversations over the last couple weeks, and again, we've identified and believe that with targeted investments of specific supportive service type activities, of pre-apprentice activities, as well as some educational programs, we think it would be prudent to increase the investment from that $1.5 million up to the $2.1 million each biennium for the workforce development opportunity. So put simply, we believe the investment will benefit not only the Department of Transportation, but also provide the heavy highway and industry with its next generation of workers. So with that, Mr. Chairman, stand down.
Chair Haas, Stephen Sims, committee members. Steve Sims, I'm the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I just wanted to say a couple of things. First of all, ODOT's been very upfront about addressing this issue of diversity, both women and people of color working in the trades, and they've been great partners to work with in this endeavor. We provide a variety of services that are outlined in the federal regulations, the things that we can do with those federal highway dollars. And we believe that the program so far has been successful. We're building on those successes. But anything we do has to be well thought out and planned. I was asked before, what's wrong with $4.1 million? Well, we don't want to spend money unless we have a plan and designated outcomes from that. For that, we've talked at length with ODOT, with our industry partners, and we believe, as Director Garrett stated, that $2.1 million would allow us, based upon the plans we currently have in place and looking for future growth and expansion of our programs, would be the right thing to do right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the administration of the program.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Knopp, and members of the committee, I'm Agnes Balassa, the Governor's Workforce Policy Advisor, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 831. As you are all aware, Governor Kitzhaber and our whole administration is very committed to assuring that economic opportunity float all boats and that underrepresented and minority populations have the opportunity to take advantage of good jobs and good wage jobs, and these jobs are good jobs. Our youth population is at record high levels of unemployment. These provide pathways for people who hadn't considered these careers as a way to engage in lifelong opportunities for economic growth. The programs described here are tried and true. They're what we use in the workforce system to try to help people understand new opportunities and to make sure that they're successful by passing through the apprenticeship with support, pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship with support services and mentoring and other types of activities that provide a greater opportunity of success for them. And so we're just here to support investing in these types of opportunities for our highway construction workforce.
Thank you. Does the federal government have any say in this? This is federal money.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, again, Matthew Garrett, Director of ODOT. Yes, federal government, again, the type of monies we use, the Surface Transportation Fund is the most flexible of federal highways. There's a list of activities that the monies can flow to, and again, it's the across the continuum of transportation investment, from bridges to highways to on the job supportive services, training to transit type issues. So again, it is a prescriptive direction from the federal government.
Okay, questions, Senator Beyer, your issue, your subject.
The only question is, if I may, Mr. Chair. The only question, I guess, of Agnes is which funding level are you recommending?
Our office is not recommending a specific funding level. We're leaving that in your hands.
That was a good answer.
Well, okay. Mr. Chair, I would say I think this is a good bill that Senator Shields has brought us. It makes good sense, and we should send it on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Connie Ashbrook, John Rakowitz, and John Mullis. Posters.
You'll say more.
Well, my students are working and could not be here today, so I brought their posters.
Good afternoon. My name is Connie Ashbrook. I'm director of Oregon Tradeswomen Incorporated, and I'm here to speak in behalf, in favor of 831 and the level of funding that CHIP is recommending. These young ladies are graduates from our pre-apprenticeship program. It was not funded by BOLI funds. It was funded by ODOT funds. It was funded by other resources that we brought into the state, so that now these young ladies are working and paying back in taxes every year more than the $5,000 cost that it took to train them so that they would be ready to be blue-collar professionals. These resources really help develop the future construction workforce that we need. And we have been meeting with folks around the state as part of our small contract that we currently have with ODOT. So we've talked to workforce investment agencies in Bend, Pendleton, and LeGrand, and these folks are hungry to be able to expand the resources that they have to provide training to the folks in their region. Umatilla School District brought 40 middle school girls to our Women in Trades Career Fair last year, and from around the state, we had 70 girls from Tillamook, 40 from Douglas County, 30 from Madras, and 36 from Tillamook High School. So these are the types of regions around the state that would really like to be able to provide training in their own area instead of having to travel to the Portland area in order to get the career education that they're hungry for. So thank you very much for your support and for your interest in providing this kind of education so that we have blue-collar professionals here to build our roads and highways around the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. This is one of a number of investments that AGC is supporting this session to help us build our pipeline. People have spoken here, including Senator Shields, about the need to grow our future workforce. We hope at some point to have a huge need, which would mean a huge recovery. But you've got to start doing that now, and that's why we support this. And the Career Tech Education Grant Education Bill is another bill that we support for that reason. We're trying to build the pipelines that you need. The particular investment we're talking about today really serves groups of people that have not traditionally been in our industry in large numbers. And frankly, in our own research and our own efforts to reach out to different populations, women and different communities of color, they don't view it as an opportunity. They don't know much about our industry. And so these kinds of efforts really make the difference in terms of reaching them out and getting them ready for an apprenticeship program. And frankly, at 3 o'clock in Senator Byers' committee, we're going to be supporting a bill on growing our apprenticeships overall in the state of Oregon by creating a utilization on public work. So you can see a theme here. We know we have a demographic problem. We know that the state's population is changing. We know we have great jobs, but there are groups of people who simply don't know that. And that's why we support this. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. John Moldis with the Oregon State Building Trades Council, here to testify in favor of the bill and in favor of Senator Shields' recommendations to move it to Ways and Means and fill in the blank there in a thoughtful manner. And I think Mr. Sims from BOLI would be able to provide a lot of very good information and background about what that right number is. We know the past, how difficult the past 4 or 5 years have been in the construction industry, and it's really created a logistics supply issue in our pipeline chain. I mean, when you've got 35 to 60% of your members unemployed, it's hard to start new apprentices because 85 to 90% of an apprentice's training is on the job. And there, so it's been harder to bring apprentices in, therefore it's harder to bring pre-apprentices in. Having said that, our apprenticeship programs and joint apprenticeship and training committees have had long and very, I think, mutually beneficial relationships with the Oregon tradeswomen and other pre-apprenticeship providers. And we wish to see those relationships and other programs continue and grow. And so I guess the takeaway that I would like to see is I know everyone in this room and everyone in the building is concerned about creating more jobs and putting people back to work. And obviously, as we continue to recover and put more work in, people to work in the construction industry, it's going to create more people or more opportunities for people to enter apprenticeship programs. It's going to create more opportunities for the graduates of these pre-apprenticeship programs to move up. And I know these pre-apprenticeship programs send our programs very good, very well-prepared candidates. So we're in support, and I would do my best to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for these three gentlemen? Thank you.
Thank you.
And I just saw Joe Esmond walk in. Joe?
I might need those.
Here, Joe. Here are 20 beers.
Hey, I like this guy. Perfect.
Maybe you don't be a foot.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Excuse me. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Senator Haas, members of the committee. Pretty much I'm going to echo what everyone else has said. This is a very good program.
Start
out with your name and ID. Joe Esmond with the IBW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. Major newspapers in the state recently spoke of the value of a vocational education in high school. It's been a long time since anybody had spoke about vocation ed in the education world. So anyway, this is a very good program. We've been hosting their annual Women in Trades Fair off and on for about 15 years. Good program. I recommend that you move it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? I'll take. Probably
Thank
not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else here to testify or
to limit?
I'm sorry. Rick Metzger and Patricia Daniels.
We got him back in the building.
Sorry, we have two sheets.
In the center.
Thank you.
I'll defer to the lady.
Okay. Good evening. My name is Pat Daniels, and I'm with Constructing Hope Pre-Apprenticeship Training Program, and I'm also here in support of Bill 831. As a new pre-apprenticeship training program, what you've heard is some of the barriers that stop people who have never been introduced to this type of work. And I'm here to just say on behalf of Constructing Hope, we're a new program. We were established in 2007. We're in support of the dollars that Senator Chip Seal is asking for, because being a program that targets people coming out of incarceration and minorities in Northeast Portland, there's a lot of money that we spend on support services to help people get ready for the trades. So part of that, a lot of it is understanding the culture, not only just the education, but the hands-on training as well as the certifications that makes a qualified candidate. As a new program, we've been mentored by Oregon Trade Women, and we've been very successful in the work that we've done in Portland. I'd like to see the same efforts duplicated in other areas. So we're very much in support of the work that has gone into this bill, and we support it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rick Metzger. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters of Oregon and Washington, and in honor of the Masters this weekend, I'm simply speaking at this point from Amen Corner, that we support the effort to increase funding as specified under 831. I will echo the comments of a few others that have been here before, is that, and I know the Ways and Means process will work well and determine what is that a correct funding level that can be used effectively to continue this very, very important outreach to diversify our workforce. It's something the carpenters are very much concerned about, and it's been a stable level for the last couple of years. I think it's time to look at how we can outreach greater, and especially to other parts of the state, as been mentioned earlier. So we're in support of that. Would like to see the bill advance.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both. Okay. Anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 831. I'm going to close a public hearing on 831, open up a work session on Senate Bill 81. Open up a work session on 831. We have the proper fiscal documentation here to send it on its way to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, did you want the dash 7 amendments to this?
I don't think anybody wants a dash 7.
All right. Let's check it. Chair Haas, I move Senate Bill 831 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 831 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is the discussion?
I'm a little interested in the dash 7s, but I guess we'll have to let it go at this point.
So. Yeah, I think we better let it go.
Okay. Yeah, okay. No further discussion. Is there objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and Senate Bill 831 with the due pass recommendation goes on to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, if I may.
Yes, sir.
I think this is a really good example. We've been talking a lot about the 40-40-20 and the inadequate funding of education programs in general. The apprenticeship programs are here. Now, this is pre-apprenticeship we're talking about here. But the apprenticeship programs are a real clear example of how the private sector and the workers, actually private and public, and working community can work together. They fund their own programs, an investment by both the workers and businesses in their labor force. And you've seen those three examples up there. The wages that were paid were pretty phenomenal for people who have worked, you know, a short period of time, quite frankly. And I happen to know from my past involvement, particularly the linemen, who caught my eye as I was arguing with, frankly, Pacific Corps when they cut their apprenticeship program, how short-sighted they were. When you look at the people in that particular industry, can easily make six figures a year doing lineman work and work wherever they want. And however frequently or long they want to work, it's amazing opportunities. And you're seeing in those industries an incredible crisis because the grain of that labor force is a problem, I'll put it that way. And that's in an industry where we can't afford not to have people who know what they're doing. So these are great efforts, and I'm glad to see, particularly very pleased to see we're getting more women and people of color into the jobs.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Those posters were great, the chronology. Okay. Before we leave, I want to announce that we are carrying over Senate Bill 818 and Senate Bill 102 to another day. With no other business before us, we are adjourned.